Good afternoon, Montreal. We're back with you. Rick McConnelly in studio with me. When you're putting together a news magazine show, some weeks are easy. The stories feed themselves. They throw themselves at you. This week has been a flood of stories, from the serious to the scurrilous, much of it meriting our attention. Overriding everything, we had wanted to focus some attention on the Canadian mission in Afghanistan. It is a mission of noble purpose. It is a mission of sacred trust. We were planning to have General Rick Hilliard, Chief of Defense Staff, with us, but due to what happened in Afghanistan over the past few days, the deaths and injuries of Canadian soldiers, he was called to Afghanistan. He's in Kandahar. The ways of response that this nation must take is one of the topics that we're going to cover, that we're going to lead with today. Because before Rick and I introduce the show and introduce our guests, I thought that we should take a few moments to remember the Corporal Davis's, Lieutenant Trevor Green's, hurt, killed in tragic and almost, in one case, senseless fashion. Lieutenant Green has now been taken to Germany for injuries from a man who broke through a mob as he was sitting under a tree and put an axe in his skull. And General Hillier had one thought when I was that he had shared before, but he also shared through his press officer. He said that when a soldier steps on foreign soil, when a Canadian soldier steps on foreign soil in a high-risk environment, every Canadian should be walking with him or her. And perhaps to reflect on those words and to expand on those words, we reach back in time to the words of Rupert Brooke, the great poet of the First World War, who wrote in a very short dedication to the young men who were on the front lines, "Blow out, you bugles, over the rich dead. There's none of these so lonely and poor of old, but dying has made us rare gifts and gold. These laid the world away, poured out the red sweet wine of youth, gave up the years to be of work and joy and that unhoped serene that men call age, and those who would have been their sons, they gave their immortality. Blow, bugles, blow. They brought us for our dearth, holiness, lacked so long, and love and pain. Honor has come back as a king to earth and pays his subjects with a royal wage, and nobleness walks in our ways again, and we have come into our heritage." We'll be right back.
Montreal, we're back, and we're discussing ways of response. How do we fight back in an appropriate manner to the war that's going on? And it is a world war, as Jim Woolsey said on his program several weeks ago, between Western liberalism and, for want of a better term at the moment, Islamist statism. And it's our privilege and pleasure to have with us Professor Alain Finkielkraut from Paris. Professor Finkielkraut is one of the outstanding philosophers of the day. His work is compelling in its intensity. And he was one of the first to warn of what we could be facing in terms of this push-me-pull-you battle or struggle between ethnic particularities and the defense of a Western liberal pluralistic model. Professor Finkielkraut, thank you for taking the time on a busy weekend to be with us.
Thank you very much.
Now, just going back a little bit, before the Danish cartoon episodes happened, you had criticized the overreaction of the Islamic community in France and the riots that occurred there, even though you expressed a sympathy for what they had gone through. And do you see any tie between that reaction and the reaction of so much of the Muslim community to the Danish cartoon controversy? And what does that mean for the building of Western, or for the strengthening of Western liberalism? What is the challenge? What gets us into D.C.?
Well, there is a challenge between, Western liberalism and Islamic fanaticism. I will call that fanaticism rather than statism. And there is a challenge because Western world doesn't now, is not able to defend its own principles. So when we have the riots, when schools were burned, the reaction in the media were very favorable to the rioters. They had all the excuses, all the reasons to burn school, and that should not have happened. Of course, the situation, the predicament of the immigrants is difficult. There is unemployment, the suburbs are not very nice neighborhoods, but still, you do not burn school. And that should have been said. And for the cartoons, there was this idea, yes, we have to defend freedom of expression, but we have to respect the values of other cultures. And we have to we must mitigate the freedom of expression and this respect. But it does not make sense. First of all, people should have been shocked by the fact that crowds in Pakistan or in Indonesia or in Saudi Arabia riot against something that happened in Denmark.
And yet we saw no riots. We saw no riots in that part of the world, either the bombings in London or Bali or Beslan or anywhere else.
No riots against the bombings, and that was, that was internal affairs of Denmark. If the Muslim community in Denmark was offended by this cartoon, they can sue the cartoonists, they can demonstrate it in Denmark, but we should not accept the idea that we live in a global village, because the global village is just the globalization of hatred, the globalization of fanaticism.
Professor Fingercross, how many people actually in Europe, in Western Europe, actually know, and I've just written a paper on it, and it's coming out in North America, but how many people in Western Europe actually know that this Abu Laban character in Denmark actually took the cartoons, added to them, and went on this tour of the Middle East, garnering support for media? Are they waiting?
We know it now. People know, and of course, and also know that but it's not only that he... I'm sorry. It's not only that he showed his cartoon, but he showed also cartoons that were not even made in Denmark. So, but, and also, people should remember that in the Islamic countries, there are a lot of cartoons. It's not that they don't want to represent religion. No, there are cartoons of Jewish characters, cartoons of the Talmud that are obnoxious, that are insulting, because they have this, that's the meaning of fanaticism. You should respect our belief, but your belief has nothing respectable. So we can insult you, but
as much as we want, but
to insult us. So, because I think that the respect of belief and the freedom of expression are two varieties of the same liberal mood. The idea that my belief is not an absolute, so that I accept other beliefs or convictions. And that should have been said. Instead, there was all this discourse about respect of beliefs and so on. And it reminded me of what happened 20 years ago with the Rushdie book.
Episode. You know? It was a one-sided respect for beliefs. Professor Finkelkraut, if you could just stay with us a few moments longer, this is fascinating. We're just going to a break and coming right back. Montreal, we're back. We're talking to French philosopher Alain Finkelkraut on the current situation in Europe and the difficulties between Western liberalism and Islamic statism and what we can expect from here. When you spoke earlier of the acceptance by the by the media of the legitimacy of the first rioting. Did that acceptance come at the beginning of the rioting or toward the end of the rioting? When did the media begin to turn?
Acceptance of what? I don't
understand. You spoke earlier of the sympathy by the media of the rioting, the Muslim rioting.
Was all along. There was, sympathy, it was compassion, it was the idea that these people are so unhappy and that they destroy everything, but they are struggling against racism. So, this barbaric behavior was tolerated, accepted, even legitimized by these comments of the political correctness in France. And that is very dangerous because it's not a way to help these poor youngsters. You know, they don't know what they are doing, and instead of telling her, reminding them of the difference between right and wrong, they are treated as victims, or even the new working class heroes. So there is no reason for them to change their behavior, but with such a behavior, you can be sure they won't find a work. So it's a kind of anti-racist, self-fulfilling prophecy.
You and I, in reading your biography, share parallel histories of sorts. Our families were both from Eastern Europe. I lost many in the Holocaust. What is it about the current problems of many Muslim immigrants in Europe that they cannot adapt to a Western pluralist tradition that says, you have a grievance, go to the court of public opinion, go to the court of law, but don't destroy people and property? Why can't they accept this, modèle républicain?
It's a mystery.
We've all suffered.
Because it's their parents and grandparents did not behave with such violence. So it has to do with ignorance, with uprooting, it's a kind of encounter between ignorance and new technologies. They don't know anything, and they see, and they are window shoppers. They see this consumer society, and they are using internet, all the screens, where everything is available. So they have this idea that they live in a world where everything is available, but they don't get it. So it's I can get no satisfaction of the 21st century.
Is there no way to get through to them the idea that freedom of religion does not imply state sanction or support for religion, and it's axiomatic that freedom of religion also implies freedom from religion if someone wants it? Is there no dialogue of that sort going on in Europe today?
It is going on, but it's not only a question of religion. It's a general behavior, because the rioters were not religious. They invoked Islam because they don't, they want the rights of nationality, but they don't
want the obligation.
See themselves as French people.
Yes,
so, there is this new insult in France, very new, dirty French. We know about dirty Jew. Now that it is in France. They say, they define themselves as Muslims, as opposed to Frenchmen, but it doesn't mean that they know about their religion, but they respect it.
It's like the debate going on in North America on certain social issues. There's all this talk about rights, but never talk about responsibilities.
Yes, of course.
Let me
think morality was just a question of human rights.
Let me touch on a final point with you. The conviction of David Irving, does that send a wrong message? In other words,
Do we really need hate laws short of incitement to violence? Should we not? Does the conviction of David Irving send the wrong message? In other words, can Islamists now say, well, look, you know, you jail a person simply for an opinion?
No, well, it's not only the question of the Islamists. I think there is no way to get along with Islamists. But I think I am uneasy, I am uncomfortable with this sentence. Because, well, it's really obnoxious to say for an historian there was no such thing as Holocaust.
Yes,
the Jews, invented the gas chamber, but Irving, at his trial, said that he changed his opinion, and maybe he's not sincere, but that's not a question for a tribunal. It should have been taken into account. Maybe he could have been condemned to a fee or something. But 3 years of jail, it sounds crazy to me.
But
send a wrong message to everybody.
To any country. Professor Finkelkraut, many thanks for your time. We will be watching your career carefully, and I would recommend to all our listeners that you pick up any one of the professor's books. They're all available here in Montreal in English and in French. Professor Finkelkraut, thank you very much again for joining us.
Bye.
That was Professor Alain Finkelkraut from Paris, and we'll be right back after this.
Montreal Ganesson, we're back. Sarah Wiseman here in the studio with Rick Economy. We've been talking about our soldiers in Afghanistan. We just talked with Professor Philosopher Alain Finkelkraut in Paris about the issues that we're fighting for and taking the fight over there to the Middle East and how it's affecting domestic economies and domestic societies in Europe. We're pleased to welcome now Ambassador Martin Pollicott of the Fraser Institute, who's written a very compelling report this week that calls on newcomers to Canada to adapt not only to the rights of landed immigrant citizens, but also to accept more obligations. Ambassador Pollicott is a senior fellow at the Fraser Institute, under whose name the report was published, and he has served as Canadian ambassador in Asia and the Middle East, Canadian High Commissioner in Asia and the Middle East, and was counterterrorism policy coordinator of the Department of Foreign Affairs. Ambassador Pollicott, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us on your weekend. Ambassador Pollicott, before getting to your paper, Professor Finkelkraut said something very interesting that I think you will agree with. He says that one of the problems in Europe is that immigrants, and in this case he was talking about radical Muslims, define themselves as Muslims, not as Frenchmen. Was this kind of an idea very much in your thoughts as you were compiling this paper? How to get immigrants to define themselves as Canadians in their universalities rather than sticking to their particularities?
Well, I don't have, that would be part of it. I certainly don't have a problem with people being Muslims or Jewish or Christian. If they think of themselves as primarily Muslim, particularly if it involves loyalties to other countries or to movements which are in conflict with Canadian values, I do have a problem. But particularly, one of the issues I raise is not precisely the one you talked about, is that our multiculturalism policy, which is Trudeau, former Prime Minister Trudeau said has been intended to help people integrate into Canadian society, Trudeau said, but it's been twisted into a celebration of their home countries. Now, I don't see a problem with people still having some ties with their home countries and their home culture, but if they come here and their primary concerns and their loyalties and so on are still to that home country, and it means they're going to get involved in conflicts in their home country using Canada as a base, that is a problem.
Is the threat to Canada, or is the threat to what they're actually doing from here in their home country?
Well, both. If you look at different groups, for instance, the Liberation Tamils of Tiger Eland have not threatened Canada, but this is a very convenient place, particularly to raise funds, and they're still doing that on a large scale, but they've never threatened Canada. However, if you look at Islamic terrorists, they have not up till now attacked Canada, but they've certainly thought about it. And Canada is one of their potential targets because they have a movement which is wants to really basically either destroy or completely transform Western countries.
Some newspapers have covered your report have had headlines such as study calls for values oath for immigrants. Now, that's obviously not exactly what you recommended, but right after this break, I'd like you to comment on that, on how you can manifest the need for immigrants to accept a more Western liberal pluralistic tradition. And we'll be right back with you after this, and with your caller, 790-0006. Montreal, welcome back. Rick McConnell in the studio, 790-0006. And we want to hear from you. What do you think of this new study from the Fraser Institute by Ambassador Martin Kolakoff that calls on new immigrants to have as much of a fidelity to Canadian principles, to Western liberalism, as they do to their home countries? Ambassador, before the break, we were asking, how do we manifest what you would like to see your goals to be?
Well, I think that's an important question. In the section of my paper where I propose this, and it's a fairly brief section, not nearly as detailed as the others, and I was throwing this out largely for discussion, I say that we have to ensure that immigrants are fully committed to Canadian values, but right after that, I get more specific. I say the kind of thing we're talking about here is a commitment not to get involved in terrorism. And later on, as a specific example. Now there may be other things. Some other people have also suggested not to get involved in major criminal activities. So I'm not just saying we've got to list out all the values. In fact, in the very next section on multiculturalism, I acknowledge that's not easy. Different people have different views, but this would have to be carefully discussed so that we're talking about extremely serious things such as either involved in terrorism activities or active support for terrorism, and not just saying, well, I support suicide bombers in general.
Before terrorism comes, of course, the acceptance of secular pluralism. Well, do you think Canada should go as far as Australia that recently told people that, listen, you want to live under, for example, Sharia law, you want parallel systems of law, please leave our country and we'll help you leave?
Well, I've said we should make it clear what our positions are, and people should not come here if they're not comfortable. I'm not sure I would want to remove citizenship for someone just because they supported Sharia law. I think it would have been better if we made clear where we stand before they got here. But it's some of the
not only Sharia law, but any other parallel system of laws to that country.
Well, I do have a problem with parallel systems of law, and I'm glad that it wasn't approved in the end, but the basis for actually stripping someone of their citizenship would have to be almost a threat to national security. So I want to clarify that, because the way my proposal's been reported by some people is if you don't accept our values in general, you're out. You know, if you don't like our position on same-sex marriage, for instance, I'm not talking about that. There's plenty of room for debate on those issues, but I'm talking about people who clearly have rejected our values, which say you don't use violence to achieve political ends, or you don't commit terrorist acts.
But how do we define those values of our own? Aren't we having that trouble now that we can't get the values nailed down? And we seem to be trying to measure someone up against something on the other side.
Martin, I know he's putting this question to you, but I'd like just to give an interesting answer, if I might. One thing we can say, for example, you remember that famous dinner that Paul Martin went to for the Tamil Tigers. We say things like, no fundraising for terrorist groups. It's very simple. It doesn't mean you lose your citizenship, but it's one of the things that we can use as a litmus test.
But you don't lose your citizenship, and you don't lose your status as an immigrant. What the hell do you lose? What are we nailing down here?
Mark, what are we nailing down?
Well, look, I admit it's not always easy to find terrorism, but that's something you have to do. The guys who flew the planes into the Twin Towers are certainly terrorists. So in terms of pinning down what they have to make a commitment to, that will take some discussion, but just because it's not that easy to define terrorism right away, it doesn't mean, well, okay, we don't do it, or we won't even worry about it. We would be, in a sense, undertaking a contract with newcomers. We'd say, look, we'll allow you to become Canadian citizens, but you have to promise not to do certain kinds of things, and your first loyalty, your only loyalty has to be to Canada. And then if it turns out that they very clearly broke these promises, it's like a contract, they're going to lose their citizenship.
Like
warned in advance so they know what's coming down the pipe.
But you're setting up two types of citizenship. I mean, once somebody gets a citizenship, they don't have obligations that are different from the guy down the street.
Right.
I was born in this country, and if I start raising funds for some terrorist group overseas, am I going to have my citizenship in doubt?
No, that's a good question, because generally I think we want to try and have exactly the same rules for Canadian-born and for naturalized. But I think this is a case where if you do it up front and in advance, there's a reasonable case for saying if a Canadian-born person commits terrorist act, that's a different problem, because you can't deport them to a country that they're not a citizen of. They're only citizens of Canada. But why make our life more complicated by bringing in troubles from abroad? Surely we
have. And this is an important point, Martin. I know your time is tight, but I want to read you something, and I want to read it to Rick as well. Perhaps it doesn't start here on our shores. Perhaps it starts at our offices around the world. Australian Treasurer Peter Costello said, if our secular values are not your values, if our pluralism is not your values, if you want a country that has laws based on theocracy, then Australia is not for you. I'd be saying to clerics that are teaching that there are two laws governing people in Australia, one the Australian law and another some theocratic version, that this is false. And if you can't agree with parliamentary law, independent courts, democracies, and would prefer a theocratic regime and have the opportunity to go to another country which practices it, perhaps then that's a better option. Is that something that our diplomats should be saying abroad to potential immigrants?
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think we welcome people from all over the world with different cultures and different backgrounds, but I don't think we should be shy about saying what our core Canadian values are and telling people just what Peter Costello said in Australia. You know, if you don't agree with these things, if you want to advocate other ways of doing things on these core values, then you shouldn't come here.
Martin Pollicott, thank you very much for your time. Martin Pollicott, author of Canada Becoming a Haven for Terrorists, Fraser Institute Study. Thank you very much, Martin.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you very much.
We'll be back, Montreal, right after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConaughey in the studio with me, and on the line we have Patrick Kiernan of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. We've been talking for the first hour about how to make Canada better, what quality of immigrants do we want, the value of our soldiers being overseas, and this is what I meant by the news this week being from the serious to the scurrilous. Now we're going to the scurrilous, and the scurrilous seems to be all at home, federally and provincially. Tasha Kieran, welcome.
Thanks, Farrell. Nice to be here.
Tasha is the Ontario Director of the Canadian Taxpayer Federation, and this week they presented their annual Piggy Teddy Awards.
That's right.
To the three levels of government that best exemplified absolute government waste. And Tasha, I was wondering about the big teddy that went to Joe Volpe for his numerous dinners one evening. What happened with that wonderful land deal that ended up as runner up, where the federal government buys a building for $90 million and a deal puts in $80 million of renovations, pays a rent to a very well known real estate company, one of whose members became a senator. I thought that was a real juicy one. How did that lose to poor Joe and his pieces?
Well, we had a lot of juicy ones this year. You're absolutely right. That one where there was a real estate contract, actually there were three buildings involved, one of which was owned by a senator, the other owned by a family with prominent ties to prime minister.
Is the senator still in the Senate?
Yes, he is, actually.
Oh, did he get to go to the Senate?
Yes, he is.
I was banging Rick McConaughey's shoulders.
I see.
Not enough the power to make Beryl the senator, I can tell you that.
We had other nominees, too. Nominees for example, a pilot project in prisons, tattoo parlors that were being opened in 6 prisons. And we called it Charlie and the Tattoo Factory. That was out of Manitoba. And there was another contract that was awarded by the Department of Indian Affairs and Urban Development to an Iowa-based company, an oral contract for $132,000.
Well, didn't Bomber give an oral contract to councils?
Well, you know what? I think that there was some mention of oral contracts in Bomber. In some cases, they thought they were...
Oh, not mention, admission. No bids, no verbal.
Right. Well, in this one, there was absolutely no paperwork. There's no idea what value for money we got. And we ended up paying $132,000. And this is where Prime Minister Jean Chrétien made that famous quip where he said, a proof is a proof. What kind of proof? It's a proof. And when you have a good proof, it's because it's proven.
We have a candidate for you. The automobile insurance of Quebec has just decided to raise by 161%, okay, the motorcycle insurance for drivers of motorcycles.
My goodness, what
and
is
it? The beauty of it is that Joshua announced, I wish they waited until after the election. I mean, who has the taxing power? It's unbelievable.
Tasha, stay with us for one moment, and we'll be right back after this.
Sure.
Welcome back, Montreal. Here in the studio with Rick McConomy. We're talking to Tasha Kierden of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation about government waste. And if you've got a bone to pick about that, we'd like to hear from you at 790-0006. Email at info@iapm.ca. Tasha, I thank you for staying with us. I know you've got a really busy weekend and you're packing. Am I allowed to stay for what reason?
Yes, you can, of course.
Tasha Kierden, to Montreal's great benefit, is coming here and she will be vice president of the Montreal Economic Institute.
That's right.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. One short week to go.
Excellent. Tasha, we kid about all these petty awards and government waste and some of the funnier stuff, but some of the bigger stuff isn't funny at all.
No, it's not.
And does this come from... You rub my back, I rub yours. Does this come from the fact that this whole huge, multicultural, touchy-feely, pork barrel, bull-grabbing complex is a balance off against the money that goes to vested interests to elect these politicians? Where's the root of the problem?
Well, there's so many roots, Beryl. You look at government waste, and the first problem is that Canadians are overtaxed. When you look at the tax levels that we have compared to the services that we're getting, there's a lot of inefficiency, and so governments take in a whole lot of money at the front end. The more they take in, the more likely they are to waste it, the more they have to play with. And so that's a problem right there. When you look at how they're actually managing the funds they get, I mean, the Gomery Inquiry revealed just how extensive the waste and outright fraud in some cases was. And this kind of thing happens when, yes, you use public money for political ends. Here it was thought that, well, the federal government...
Unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to take a look at Martin's contracts with CSL, Ernst & Young, various other things.
Well, that's a whole other story.
But
in terms of spending money, you have this attitude in Canada all too often that it's the government that's the solution to our problems. Yes. Only the government can stop separatism, for example.
Have we lost a sense of our own individual consequences and possibilities?
Well, I think that we certainly have, I think it's been diminished. It's not like we've completely lost it. In fact, I think we want to get it back. I think there's a movement afoot, and interestingly enough, very much so in Quebec, of the need to downsize government to run it more efficiently. You saw even last year, Lucien Bouchard put out a call for smaller government. And this kind of thinking, I think, is catching on. People realize that the more the state takes away from you, the more it can waste. And it can't give you anything it hasn't taken from you first. That's what you always have to remember.
Thank you very much, and I want to remind our listeners that Tasha Kierden is the co-author of now a bestseller, I believe, number 7, Canada,
yes.
Rescuing Canada's Right, Blueprint for a Conservative Revolution, which she co-authored with Adam Daisala, and it's from John Wiley and Sons. Thank you very much, Tasha.
Pleasure, girl. Thank you so much.
Amazing move. Thanks, Tasha. We're back with Don McPherson. Continuing our discussion of where government is taking us. Don, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Don is the Montreal Gazette's Quebec analyst par excellence, and we're talking this hour about, you know, citizens getting dumped on, government waste, the government inquiries and tribunals in their lives, not getting the benefits of doubt. Later on, we'll be talking on the problems of due process. We just lived through a week in Quebec with it was the SAQ, the Auto Insurance Board, a lot of Quebec, the casinos. But I know that you particularly want to talk about what happened with the cabin shuffle and Tomo Care, and are we being taken for granted? Is a guy who's doing a good job just hasn't got a chance to stick around?
Well, I think perhaps the problem with Tomo Care as a minister of what they can now call sustainable development is that he did too good a job, that he failed to realize that what Premier Shaddai appointed him to the job, that what he wanted is a lot of development and not much sustainable. There are stories that the official line out of the Premier's office is that Tomo Care didn't work well with others. But the unofficial story, and this is a story that's starting to emerge, is that Tomo Care upset a number of his cabinet colleagues and the Premier by being opposed to by actually doing his job and resisting development projects. In particular, there's a story that he ran afoul of developers in the Eastern Townships who are close to Chaudet, who want to open up the Mont Orford Provincial Park for condo development.
Don, stay with us for just a moment. Can I just pay some bills and be right back with you? Montreal, we're back at the Connolly's studio with you. We're talking about due process, government accountability, and specifically right now, we have on the line one folks, that's Don McPherson, Quebec analyst for Excellence. We're talking about the Mont Care affair. Gee, that rhymes, Don. The Mont Care affair. Don, you're telling a great point during the break. I wanted to start
you're telling us that Mont Care had some trouble sharing and playing with the rest of the kids. Is it partially in fact that they're bringing in PQs like Bacha into the Liberal cabinet? I mean, they did it with BQ federally. Now they're doing it with PQs locally. It's like a PQ goes in and an Anglo goes out. Are these two connected?
Well, they're connected in the sense that this cabinet shuffle was prompted by the fact that Raymond Bachand was coming in, and that was, of course, was Chaudet's trophy recruit in the by-election in Outremont back in December. The interesting thing about Mulcair's demotion, I mean, he was offered a major demotion. Everybody except the Premier's office seems to think of it as a major demotion.
Well, Chaudet's paper clips are important, though.
Well, no, this is actually brochures.
Okay, sorry.
He's actually going to be put in charge of setting up these new Service Quebec single wicket service points where people could go to the government and find out exactly what service they need. It was clearly a demotion, and as the surprise is that the Premier's office thought that that Mulcair might actually accept to lose face in that way. What's interesting about this, you talked before about government taking the voters for granted. I think this is one case where this really does apply. There are a number of other people in the cabinet now, regardless of what one might think of Mulcair's performance and his record. There were certainly a lot of other people in the cabinet who deserved to be demoted or sent relegated to the backbenches outright. People such as Carol Thibault, for example, the family minister, Nathalie Novmanteau, the minister of municipal affairs, both of them were mentioned at least as much as Mulcair was in the pre-cabinet shuffle speculation as to who was a candidate for demotion or expulsion from the cabinet, but neither one of them was moved. And I think the reason for that is that Mulcair was expendable as a non-francophone cabinet minister representing a safe seat with a lot of non-francophone voters. Well, the Liberals know that they can take those voters for granted, and as a result of that, they weren't worried about the electoral consequences of Mulcair's leaving the cabinet rather than accepting the demotion that they offered him.
And it's not, I think that one charade trotted out Jeff Kelly. He actually gave an interview in which he said, well, Anglo-Quebecers shouldn't be concerned because even the Raymond Bachand is a francophone, there's a lot of Anglos in Outremont. Or there's a lot of Anglos in Mount Royal. He gives that as another example of Philippe Pial.
Yeah, but the fact is there aren't a lot of Anglos in the Liberal cabinet right
That's
now.
That's correct.
There are 26 cabinet ministers right now, and there are only two non-francophones left. There's Jeff Kelly. And there's Lawrence Berkman. Those are the only two non-francophones left in the cabinet. They make up about 8% of the cabinet, while they make up about 19% of the population here in Quebec. So they're seriously underrepresented, and that's another way in which this taking the non-francophone vote for granted on the part of the Liberals makes itself felt.
You should recall we also have the withdrawal of Russ Williams not so long ago, which began some kind of an effect where, you know, they're tumbling one after another.
Well, that's right. I mean, Russ Williams left the National Assembly, and he was followed shortly thereafter by Christos Syros.
Right.
Both of whom were were prominent non-Francophone liberals. Both of them were at least as qualified as some of the people who did make it into the cabinet and are still there. But they realized that their chances of getting into the cabinet were slim, and they weren't interested in sticking around as backbench MNAs, and so they left.
Don, thanks very much for joining us on a Sunday. Thanks for taking the time off. And Montreal, if you're pissed off on this issue, if you think you're underrepresented, let's hear from you. 790-0006 right after this. Thanks, Don. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking about getting screwed by government, whether it's state waste, whether it's lack of due process, whether it's lack of government accountability, whether your vote's taken for granted. We've seen a flood this week of stuff from Hydro-Quebec rate increases, FAQ, price fixing, a lot of Quebec moving casinos into poor areas to satisfy developers, the auto insurance board raising their rates ridiculously. These agencies were supposed to protect us. This kind of second tier or the second pillar of Quebec Inc. was supposed to protect Quebecers from these very problems of the voraciousness of the private sector. In exchange for that, they become taxers. They're the ones that now make the taxes on their own. They don't go through the government.
Right up the kazoo with a hot rod.
Well, that's the motorcycle thing.
That's the motorcycle thing, which we'll get to. But before we get to a major discussion of all this, we want to see if this kind of Quebec model could ever have worked. And with us on the line and joining us from Vancouver is Adam Daifala. Adam, welcome.
Hi, Darrell.
Thank you for joining us on what I know is a very busy weekend. Just to introduce you to our audience, Adam Daifala has a CV that would make someone twice his age blush. He's been on the editorial board of the National Post. He's been a Sobey scholar, co-author of Rescuing Canada's Right. He worked with Donald Black on the Franklin Roosevelt biography, and he's now, after all that success, is putting himself through the grind of law school at University of Laval. How are you, Adam?
I'm doing great. Adam, it's a lot warmer in Vancouver than it is in Quebec City.
And you're there, I believe, to give a talk to the Fraser Institute?
Yeah, I'm speaking on Tuesday here.
Adam, in your book, Rescuing Canada's Right, you had a section on statism and how statism and the nanny state economy is bound to turn into the citizen's worst nightmare. Could we have avoided what now looks like all the dominoes in Quebec Inc. falling? Or was this inevitable?
Well, I think it was inevitable. What's happened in the last little while, and especially in the last week, the cases that you cited, Darrell, is an example of big government run amok, and it's a result of just this insatiable appetite for the Quebec government to need to raise money, and it's a result of the big government policies that have been adopted in Quebec and have continued under the Charest government, frankly, even though he was elected on a promise to really get it under control. I personally like the way that you put it. It's institutions and organizations that were built to protect people and the consumer, and they're doing the complete opposite. They've become predatory organisms. So it's offensive.
And I'm feeling that word, predatory. They don't seem to be accountable to anyone at the same time.
No, and that's the biggest problem with this whole thing, is that they're absolutely not accountable to anyone. And it's hilarious how the SAQ story went along with the Hydro story, because of the SAQ controversy, prices are dropping or have dropped, and it's almost like as a commensurate response to that, because of the revenue going down from the SAQ, Hydro announces a rate hike to make up for that shortfall in cash.
With the surpluses from both organizations going back into the general accounts of the Treasury as of 18 months ago.
Exactly, yeah.
Can you stay with us? Adam Naeem is still on the line. He wants to talk about this whole cabinet. Naeem, welcome.
Yes, sir. How are you, sir?
We're well. How are you?
Well, I'm not happy at all. I'm here for 30 years in Montreal. You know, and I have been liberal.
Right.
In town of Mount Royal, you know, our MLA is Mr. Philippe Couillard. Exactly. And before that was John Chiata, but how come I don't want to make any personal attack on Mr. John Chavez, but I am as a politically...
Why not? He's in politics. That's what
I'm
about.
I can be next time, I can be in city council or somewhere that I'm very well known. I am the director general or executive director of the Pakistani community. And
are you mad about these rate hikes? Are you mad about lack of representation?
Sure, it's terrible. They have gone up to 11 point something. It's too much, you know. People, they are having other expenses not to pay in. From 2004, I think, January, up till now, they have done 11.4%.
And what is the Pakistani community able to do?
Well, Pakistani community is there to tell them, to make them realize that we are here in maybe 25,000 Pakistanis in all Quebec. And we are the people who work hard. And
and the people that are hit the hardest with these raises in funds. Thank you for calling, and keep up the good work. You're fighting the good fight. Adam, we'll be right back with you, and we'll be right back with you, Montreal, right after this, we'll pay some bills. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking about due process, government accountability, and how we're not getting our money's worth, nor are we being properly represented. Email info@iapm.ca, and we're just finishing up on the line with Adam Daifala, who's been very patiently waiting from Vancouver. Adam, I know you're pressed, but I want to ask you one final question. Our lines have lit up here, and you've heard Naeem before. There's a great frustration on the part of people that they do not feel that they can get through to their elected representatives. They don't feel they're being represented on the issues that matter to them. They just feel that they keep coming back for more and more and more to the public draw. Is there any way to channel and harness that?
It's possible, and it's been done in the past. You could cite many examples of it in Canada and elsewhere. One good example of it would be the Reform Party in 1987 that obviously channeled the frustration of Western Canadians. And it's happened in Quebec even, of course, with the Equality Party and other movements. It could happen. It's extremely difficult, and I'm afraid I'm a little bit too much of a cynic these days to think that it could actually be successful. But, it's always worth trying.
Adam Daifala, co-author of Rescuing Canada's Right, we thank you for being with us. Don't be a cynic. Remember Frederick the Great. Audace, toujours l'audace. Thanks very much for being with us, Adam.
Best of luck in your law studies, Adam.
Cheers.
Cheers. Well, Montreal, we now come to a point where I am almost left speechless, and McConomy's mouth just about...
I can't believe it.
He can't believe it. But, you know, when Pablo Casals, the great cellist, played the White House, John Kennedy said there is now more talent in this room than at any time since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. So I want to welcome not only our friend McConomy here, former Bethanier of the Bar, former president of United Way Canada, Grand Marshal of the Baptist Day Parade, but I have another Bethanier of the Bar who's now just joined us, Mr. Pierre Fournier. Welcome, Pierre. And on the line is Canada's leading constitutional and civil liberties lawyer, Julius Gray. Welcome, Julius.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
Okay.
Gentlemen, Montreal, you have three of the finest legal and political minds at your disposal. And Rick gave a wonderful line to me this week. He said, you know, it's not just about Hydra raising rates and SAC raising rates and the SAQ price fixing and paying over $1 million to their executives. It's not just about a lot of Quebec moving casinos so maybe certain developers can exercise land options. It's about all these organisms of the state raising their rates, which is indirect taxation. Whoever said that the state government of Quebec ceded the right to tax? Here's Hydro-Quebec running off to the Régie de l'énergie. They make a little case. Boom. Whack. 2.5 years later, 10% increases. And you know what happened, of course, he pointed out to me. The last time there was taxation without representation, and that was only for a one-penny tax stamp. That led to something called the Boston Tea Party in 1776, which led to the Battle of Concord, which led to the American Revolution, which led to the birth of a great new nation. Anybody out there feeling like being great? Anybody out there feeling like a revolution? Gentlemen, let's talk. Can this whole thing be controlled?
Mr. Chiarot got elected promising no increase in taxes. And we finally discovered that he had no control over the no increase in taxes, that the taxing powers had been delegated. Maitre Gray, can I hear from you?
Well, I fear that...
Well, that sigh, that pregnant sigh.
What I fear is that wonderful French word, dégringolade, the falling apart of a public system, which, contrary to our friend Adam, I say before, I think could have worked and could work. I think we're seeing a realignment in Quebec, a general fatigue and a realignment on the right, a new sort of right-wing nationalist Federalist Party, which combines people like Mr. Bachand, people like Mr. Charest, and possibly in the end, people like the ADQ. And
includes people like Mr. Mulcair.
Yeah, well, it gets rid of people like Mr. Mulcair, who was the best minister there.
Jurgens, I'm sorry, hold the thought. I'm being signaled, we've got to pay a bill. We'll be back in a minute. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking about, is the state becoming public enemy number one? How much more of this should we pay? Hydro rates going up by 10% over 2 years. The SAC involved in price fixing, and if not that, the bottle is still 60-80% of the cost of a bottle of wine or spirits goes to the government either in taxes or fees. A lot of Quebec moving the casino into one of the poorest areas of Montreal, spending only 1% on gambling-related problems, and the automobile insurance board completely out of touch with any kind of reality with their inflation rates, and they were supposed to protect us from this. Rick McConaughey is in the studio with me, so is Mr. Pierre Fournier, former Bathing of the Bar of Montreal, and Julius Idick Gray on the line, Canada's leading civil liberties attorney. And Julius, I stopped you in mid-thought.
Yes, my thought was that the fault is not only that of the new right-wing movement, which I think could destroy our Quebec way, but also of people who believe in the government, like myself. I think we have to understand that the model has to be changed. It has to become leaner, it has to become frugal, and we have to de-bureaucratize. And I think there's an option. Either we privatize, which is what the right wants, what Mr. Klein wants, and I don't want that, or we de-bureaucratize. The unions recognize that their role is not to run the system, but only to protect the workers' rights.
The problem, Julius, of the bureaucracy is not just on raising the rates to pay the bureaucrats. We already in Quebec are four times the number of bureaucrats as California with one-fifth the population. But that these bureaucrats in non-business tribunals, in everything from lobbyist registries to the other dozens of organisms that the state has to find out what we're thinking, who we're talking to, they just come into our lives with reckless abandon. How much of this should Quebec take?
Arbitrary power. It's also that which turns people off the whole notion of government and the whole notion of the redistribution. And yet people are not richer than they were 15 years ago, despite claims that there's been growth. There's especially the gap between rich and poor is growing. So obviously, those of us who believe in redistributing, we have to get together and plan a new model, which is leaner. I'd say Tommy Douglas rather than the Bob Ray version of the 90s. We should look at a very, very simple and direct redistribution and not a complex and difficult bureaucratic spending.
Change the subject for a minute. You know, this week the book came out by Francois Perrault called Inside Domery. I want to keep you on the line, Julius, to get your views on some of that. Just reading from the book itself, critics contend, and I quote, critics contend the pressure exerted by media, the laxity of rules for admission of evidence, and the broad scope allowed the examinations can cause excessive damage to individuals' reputations. Domery claimed that the 400 or so provincial and federal commissions inquiry created since Confederation has been beneficial for the most part, helping to maintain a balance between individual rights and the collective interest. Pierre Fournier, can I hear something from you on that?
Well, there's no doubt that there is a collective interest, and I certainly wouldn't say we have to get rid of all commissions of inquiry. I think what is different in this passage of the book that you just quoted is the idea that the media has some kind of role to play in formulating where the line should be drawn. And in my understanding of things, the commissioner is the guardian of the civil liberties. He is the person who will protect my reputation, not the media. The media are not there to sell paper.
Adam, here we have a caller that's going to come on now named John. He says, don't give the government too much power. Why are we supposed to believe that a one-man commission, even Stalin had
three judges. Why are we supposed to be so naive to believe in the, quote, purity and independence of a one-man commission?
Because the one man is works within a system which will call them to question, and that's why you have judicial review.
Says who? He gave Francois Perrault the right to write this book in the second month of the Garment Commission. He avoided putting into the final report uncontested evidence that he chose, and there was no oversight over him. So where's judicial equity?
The oversight is there. That's what judicial review is about.
But you have to have so much money to do it. John, what do you mean don't give government too much power?
Well, what I mean is that when you entrust government to take care of its citizens from the cradle to the grave, this is what you wind up with.
A naive belief in the power of government to do only what's right for you without consulting you?
I'm a Republican. I left this country 40 years ago and turned 2 years ago to my dismay to see that Marxism is the only authoritarian state that you have here.
Well, Marxism is pure. We're heading towards Stalinism. It's a little different.
You've had the opportunity on this radio station to interview Judge Gomery. And the questions that were asked of him were questions that, you know, about his trip to Spain. The only thing they didn't ask
hard
was
stuff.
Color.
Where did you live for 40 years?
In Atlanta, Georgia.
And you gave up Atlanta weather for this?
I have to come back here for personal reasons, for family reasons, but I can't wait to return because, the government is involved in every lucrative operation to get a permit.
Underline the word lucrative.
I'm lucrative.
Underline the word lucrative.
SAQ is one of them. The SAQ is one of the establishment. Gambling is the second one that they're heavily involved in. They control every aspect of the life. And this man who says the Quebec way, we're going to lose our Quebec way because we're going to a righteous way or to the far right. Does anybody ever remember Mel Laskin handing out the keys of the city of Toronto to the Hells Angels?
We'll be right back. Julia, stay with us right after we pay some bills. Montreal, we're back with Freak Metonymy. That's Pierre Fournier and Julia's great talking about whether the system has gone all to hell, not only on issues of compromising the public trust where money's concerned, but on the invasiveness of public tribunals and inquiries on everything from Garmory to lobbyist registries. Gentlemen, who wants to lead off?
Pierre, why don't you talk to us about judicial review?
Well, judicial review, as it stands, is not an easy process. It's a very long, complicated, and costly process. So it's not available to everyone who's being defamed in those commissions. But where you have the wherewithal, it is a useful process that can lead, as it did in other inquiries, that can lead to overturning the decisions or the recommendations of the commissioner. What it does, in effect, is it acts as a break on what the commissioner is supposed to do. Some commissioners are more susceptible to that than others, but it's there for that purpose.
And, in effect, there is judicial review pending in front of the federal court.
There are presently three motions for judicial review of the Gomery report that are pending.
And in the Perrault book, he talks about, you know, how unjust and how awful it seems to be that these things are pending and attacking the court commissioner. But we're talking here about allegations of gross error in fact, unfairness in treatment of witnesses. We're talking about the chief counsel being under attack. We're talking about Perrault himself. And it seems that this book that he's written is a defense to that particular view.
That's part of what I find strange about that book is that what comes out of this book is that not only the commissioner and Mr. Perrault, but everybody surrounding that commission seems to have been extremely worried about what the media were thinking about them or saying about them. And that's what you don't expect from a commissioner. You expect the commissioner to work not in a vacuum, but to work without being worried about his reputation or how popular he is in the public. And the book seems to give a strange whiff of the commissioner being too worried about his image.
Pierre, Julius, do you think, though, that if a constant judicial review is really available to ordinary Canadians and $100,000 in legal fees?
To ordinary Canadians, surely not. And any type of judicial recourse is not available to ordinary Canadians.
And is it right that this book got Montgomery sanctioned to his own PR guy 2 months into the commission?
Well, I don't want to comment on that. I think I've always had the greatest respect for Mr. Justice Gomery, but the whole system of commission, I have some doubt about, because a commission is by its very nature a way of getting around the protections of criminal law by saying that you're not accused. You're not accused, so we can ask questions more broadly, and sometimes it can be useful. And I think that in here it wasn't on some of the issues, but not necessarily of all. And there is a threat to civil liberties from that sort of cross-examination of people. For instance, if you look at the anti-terrorist law, it certainly allows the judge to hold broad inquiries without having an accusation or anything else. It's obviously very dangerous. And I want to bring you back to the whole topic.
Julius Richards had a comment on that.
Yeah, the whole thing is, you know, if you hire yourself a first-class operator in the media, and he goes through this entire book explaining how he managed the press, and he put the press releases together, and everything ready, and everything was set and set to go, and it seems to me that if you're having an investigation, and at the same time, I mean, the Supreme Court has said it in the Commission de l'Autorité des Courses. And basically, if you have the commissioner, or the decider, and you have the pleaders, and the people that are doing that, and then a PR guy that's in charge of getting them going, and they all have the same secretarial, now, it seems to me that there's a conflict that's basically there, that the agenda is to go after the people.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time for today. I want to thank Julius Gray, Pierre Fournier, Rick McConomy, who's in the studio with me. Montreal, we've shown you the problems. We've shown you that there are allies. We've shown you how to attack the problems. Now it's up to you. Start writing. Start getting angry. Start getting mad as hell. That's it for now. We're out of here, and we'll see you next week.